Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show.
If you've ever woken up with a hangover, if you've ever done something under the influence that left you with regrets, or if you or anyone you know struggles with alcohol or drug addiction, today's story of recovery, second chances, and how to have a new look on life so you can get a new lease on life is going to be a game changer. Especially when you hear the four words that helped change my friend's life and how he was able to disconnect his past story that was holding him back from the amazing future he has ahead. Hi, this is Craig Valentine, and all will be revealed in this powerful episode of Early to Rise Radio. Early to Rise Radio is brought to you by my new book, Unstoppable, and my first game-changing book, The Perfect Day Formula, How to Own Your Day and Control Your Life. Grab your free copy at freeperfectdaybook.com so you can improve every area of your life. Now listen, we all make mistakes. Some are bigger than others. But imagine I told you a story where you were putting yourself in a prison, literally and figuratively. Imagine you had hit rock bottom. Imagine you had to call the cops on yourself. On yourself. What would that do to you? How would you decide to move ahead and make a change? Or would you stay in the depths of despair? Would you dig deep and find a way to transform adversity into advantage? Well, what you're about to hear is a remarkable story of my friend Sam Morris, who admittedly made a big mistake. He lost it all. He lost it all. Girlfriend, job, money, friends, family. And then he found his way back. He found his way back. And today he loves life. He overcame social anxiety. He's one of the most positive, outgoing people now that I know. He's gone on to do absolutely amazing things since he hit rock bottom, since he went on his hero's journey. And he teaches me something every week, and he has an incredible outlook on life that we should all incorporate. So you got to hear this one. Got to hear this one. All right. So let me start with introducing my friend and coaching client, Sam Morris. Sam found salvation and success through the 12-step program, even though he rejected it at first. And he also found salvation through his career as a personal trainer. Today, though, he's something more than that. He's a recovery coach. And if you're struggling, I urge you to listen to his journey and reach out to him at the end of our call. All right? I mean, he has some crazy stories he's about to share. So let's get started with it. And how what happened to him paralleled a lot of my life as well. All right. So Sam, you're a recovery coach. I guess that means you went through some recovery of your own. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I'll work backwards on it. So the recovery of my own started legitimately in 2012, November 21st, 2012. It was 4 a.m. and I had been on a two-month bender. And I.
Where are you? What city?
In Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
In my addiction, there's things called geographics, which is moving places to fix your surroundings, to fix your insides, thinking that fixing your outsides will fix your insides.
Uh-huh.
When in reality, the truth is wherever you go, there you are. So I had tried all these. I moved from North Carolina to Florida, back to North Carolina, back to Florida, and finally I was back in North Carolina in 2012. And I had been sober for 11 and a half months and basically stopped.
Before the 2 months?
Yeah, prior to the 2 months, I was sober for 11 and a half months.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in Florida, moved back to North Carolina, and then stopped doing all the things I had done to get the 11 and a half months of sobriety.
Which were
going to meetings, doing the work, calling a sponsor, basically being vigilant about the stuff that sober people do.
Basically from the 12-step program.
12-step
yeah.
program,
yeah, okay.
Exactly. So I thought I had it on my own. And I always had in the back of my head, I had that reservation that when I hit 1 year, I was going to reevaluate this whole sobriety thing.
Oh.
Yeah, and because part of my recovery is that I just never got the actual pain of it. Like it was, so for a long time, and as I work backwards, I'll tell you, for a long time in my life, I actually did control my drinking. And there were some other factors that led to me controlling it, but I always had in the back of my head that it was just one bad night or a bad stretch or some bad events happened that led me to my drinking. So I never really put two – I never admitted that the two were correlated, like the bad stuff in my life and the drinking.
Got it.
I always kind of separated the two as separate events. So it was 4 a.m. on November 21st, 2012, and I had been drinking for 2 months after the year of sobriety.
Okay.
And I was supposed to move out of my house the next day because in this 2 months, I had been in jail for 7 days from a DUI. I had my dog in the car when I got the DUI. I lost the dog from that. I had lost my job. I was in commercial real estate. And to say I lost my job is kind of glorifying it. I basically just stopped going to work.
Wow.
just so I could keep drinking. Like, okay. It just work wasn't on the radar. Like, it was like not a priority at all. So that had gone away. My house, I had to move out because I couldn't no job, couldn't pay rent. So I was getting ready to move out of my house the next day, and my dad had given me about $1,000 to pay the movers and to get boxes and all the tape and stuff like that to pack up the house. Well, I had 3 days to do that, and I spent the 3 days drinking and doing drugs with that money instead of hiring the movers and all that. So it was 4 a.m., and the movers were scheduled to come at 8 a.m. And I had no money. And if you had walked into the house at that moment, you would have been like, oh, it's a nice house. Somebody actually lives here. So basically, there was no packing that had been done.
Right.
No boxes, furniture all still there, like TV all connected, everything. So I was immediately stricken. I had a moment of clarity where I was stricken with fear.
So you were just up and drinking at this time?
I was drinking and doing drugs. Right. I had a bottle of Captain Morgan's and a pile of cocaine in front of me.
Right.
It was 4 a.m. and it all of a sudden occurred to me that in 4 hours I was supposed to be packed up and moved out of this house.
Right.
And I had no way of doing that. So I called 911 and told them I was having suicidal thoughts. Now, I wasn't, but I had tried that before. And they basically, if you call them up and you just say, I'm super drunk and super high, can you help me? They're just going to be like, go to sleep.
Oh.
And I was like, that's not going to work because that means I still have to face tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I made up that I was having suicidal thoughts. And so they came and took me to the psych ward. And so I was in the psych ward for 7 days in North Carolina. And then right from the psych ward, I literally got...
And that's over Thanksgiving.
Yes, over Thanksgiving. So I was in the psych ward over Thanksgiving. A van literally took me from the hospital to the airport in North Carolina, where I flew to Michigan to go to a rehab.
Okay.
I was in rehab for my birthday on December 5th. I was in that rehab for Christmas on December 25th. I was in that rehab for New Year's. And then after all that New Year's and 6 weeks in that rehab, I knew that it wasn't enough. And I knew I needed more help. And I was ready at this point to get help.
Uh-huh.
So I went back to another rehab that I'd been to previously, stayed there for another 2 months, and then did sober living for 3 months in Utah.
Okay.
And that was 6 years ago. And then I had been sober since that day, six years ago in a few months.
Okay. And so what was it, when you left sober living, did you think like, okay, now I've got it? And what made you think like I need more and from that first rehab to like?
So the rehab that I went to in Michigan was not 12-step based.
Okay.
Meaning that I had tried 12 steps for so long that I was kind of angry at it. I was kind of upset. It didn't work. I used to say it didn't work for me. In reality, I had to switch that whole statement and be like, I didn't work for it.
Got it.
Because obviously nothing works for you if you don't work for it. So I was always like, oh, those rehabs don't work for me. AA doesn't work for me. I had all these excuses built in.
It's like when people say this diet doesn't work. Well, the diet
right.
works. You don't work.
It's like doing keto and eating a bunch of carbs along with it. Like,
right.
You're not just not doing it right.
Right.
So I went to this Scientology-based rehab.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Utah one?
Yeah. No, this is the one in Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it was... it was a weird situation.
So have you read the book Dianetics? Is that
no? But this was based on a lot of that stuff.
Okay.
It's L. Ron Hubbard did the stuff. There's a lot of it's Scientology based with like the detox and the saunas and Scientology actually has its own addiction recovery wing, I guess you could call it.
Uh-huh.
So they base it all on this, and I went there and I said to myself, this is the strangest environment I've ever been into. It was really uncomfortable. It was a terrible situation, really low budget. And so I said to myself, you know what? Like, okay, 12 steps are better.
God.
Like I finally was.
You hit rock bottom in your rehab program.
Yeah, I did. After I got sober, I actually hit another rock bottom.
Right.
So I said, I told my parents, I was like, okay.
Well, how did you get to this one?
This in Michigan?
Yeah.
So I told my parents, everybody, I was like, I'm not doing 12 steps. So find me a rehab that is not 12 step based.
Okay.
And so they found this one in Michigan, and they talked to the intake guys, and they basically upselled it, and it was an amazing place with the amazing results. It was not like that.
Got it.
So I knew then that the 12 steps was the best way. Like, I needed a 12-step program to get sober. So I had been in 2007. In 2007 is when my journey on recovery actually started. I had DUI in 2007. Uh-huh. And I went to a rehab in Florida, and then I went to this rehab in Utah in the fall of that year. I'll go into that in a little bit, but I knew that it worked. I knew it was the best rehab in the country, and I knew the counselors there were good, and I knew that if I wanted this to work, I was ready to do the work for it.
Okay.
So I knew this was the best place to go.
So there was 5 years in between when you went there the first time,
right,
and when you went the second time.
And there's a lot of bumps on the bottom along the way.
Sure.
And so I went back to this rehab, and what changed for me and what I knew now is that I basically was done. My body was done. My mind was done. My family was done. And when I say my family was done, like, they were done for a long time.
Yeah.
But like
everything else was now done too.
Yeah. And the dynamics of the family was done. Like, I knew that I couldn't show up this way in my family anymore.
Got it.
Like, I knew, I saw when I was in the psych ward, my dad, who he was 69 or 70 at the time,
uh-huh,
and he came to visit me in the psych ward, and the look on his face was, I see, he was gray, his eyes were sunken, he was sad, like, he looked like he was about to die. His voice was quivering,
uh-huh,
and I saw this effect that I was having on him.
Got it.
And the rest of the family. And
yeah.
I was like, I don't care what it takes, like, this has to end now.
Okay.
And for me too. Like, I mean, so the times I had relapsed before, with the drinking, everything kind of comes back a lot. Like, the job will come back, the girlfriend will come back, the money will come back, like, the family will come back. You can talk people off ledges, and this time none of that came back.
Got it.
And so I really had nothing. Like, it was like I was at complete rock bottom. You know, they say, like, rock bottom is the place the foundation I built my life on. This is actually true now.
Okay.
So I was experiencing this. I was homeless. I had no car. I had lost my dog. The girlfriend had left. Like, all this stuff had happened. So I was really out of options.
Yeah. Okay. So were you going to say something else there?
No, that's it. Go ahead.
Okay. So that was 6 years ago now.
Yeah.
And how difficult has it been?
You know, it's funny. People ask me that a lot. It's not really been that difficult
because you were done?
I was so done. It was at the end of my rope. So I'll go back to 2007 when it all started.
Okay.
And then 2007 I had moved down to Florida from North Carolina with my ex-wife.
Uh-huh.
We got divorced, and I had moved down to Miami. So I was in Miami for 3 years, and this was from the age of 30 to 33 is when I can see a precipitous drop off of a cliff.
Okay.
The increase in my drinking and partying, and the drop off of the quality of life.
Okay.
It took 3 years to set in and hit home, but like, my relationships were awful. My career, I was a very unsuccessful commercial real estate broker.
Okay.
Showing up at work all the time drunk, still drinking at work, all that stuff. You just can't. It doesn't work. So all these things, it took me a while to see it. But from age 30 to 33, so I turned 33 in 2007. In the spring of that day, in 2007, I believe it was a February day.
Yeah.
I had been out all
night. We call that winter up in Toronto.
Yeah, not.
But if you want to call it spring, go ahead.
In Miami, it's different.
Right.
It's all one spring.
Right.
So I had been out that night, the night before, and I'd stayed up all night partying with some friends, and I woke up and then I kind of came to in the morning and realized I didn't have my wallet. At least I thought I didn't have my wallet. And I was hungry and needed some food, so I called my girlfriend. I was like, hey, can you take me to get my car? It's at the parking deck at the bar. I left there the night before because I was being responsible drinking, right?
Yeah.
So I get in my car, I'm driving down the street, looking for my wallet all over the car, glove box, you know, console, all that stuff. And I just blow through a red light and T-bone another driver. And so I had literally been stopped drinking about an hour before this.
Got it.
So the cops show up and I'm slurring my words and they smell alcohol on me and my breath smells and all this stuff. And they take me in. So DUI.
Yeah.
So after that DUI, I go to a rehab in West Palm Beach. And this is my first real, like, you have a problem, like, lawyers are saying you should probably go get this checked out, like, take care of this. And I'm like, yeah, it was a bad night. Like, it was just a wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
Never thought that I need to stop drinking. And even my girlfriend, I talked about it. I was like, I'm just going to go away for 30 days. I'm going to come back and then we can continue to go out and drink together and all this stuff. It's just, I just need to figure some stuff out.
Got it.
So I did that. I actually talked my way out of that rehab 2 days early to go to a wedding. And I stayed sober for about 2 weeks, but then I started drinking again.
Okay.
And immediately the behavior right back to how it was when I was drinking. So my drinking behavior shows up as I go AWOL for everybody in my life for 3 to 4 days, 5 days, however long I'm drinking for. Don't call anybody. Stay up for 3 or 4 days, spend a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You know, just all kinds of just my – everything else in my life besides drinking and doing drugs gets put on hold.
Huh.
So that means relationships, jobs, any kind of responsibility I have, family, anything like that.
Yeah.
So
why? So how does it actually end after 3 to 4 days? Is it just like body?
Yeah, body just shuts down.
Got
it. I fall asleep wherever I am. Usually I'll make it home by that point because no one else is with me, and I'm.
Got it.
Everyone else falls off. And
yeah. Okay.
No people don't do that.
Right.
So I'm usually alone after the fifth day and drinking and at home, and I just kind of pass out.
Okay.
So that's how that ends. And then so after 3 weeks, back from rehab, right back into that behavior. Nothing was fixed at all.
Yeah.
And so my girlfriend left me at this point. She's like, I can't be around this, and I can't watch you do this to yourself. I love you, but this is killing me, and it's killing you, and I can't be a part of this anymore.
Okay.
So that sent me into a deep depression, where to the point where the first time in my life, I was actually using alcohol now to run away from life.
Okay.
I was like, so my blinds were drawn all the time, and I was either drinking or taking Benadryl to sleep.
Wow.
There was no in between.
Okay.
So this went on for 3 more months and into August. And then, October. So then in October, I went to Utah. This is now still 2007. I went to Utah and back to that to the rehab for the first time in Utah.
How did you find it?
So my uncle had been there and his daughter had been there. So
okay.
It was my dad knew about it. And he was like,
okay.
he called me up and he said, listen, he's like, whenever you're ready, there's a bed there for you. Just let us know.
Okay.
So like a few days later, I was like, okay, I'll go.
Okay.
So I stayed there for 2 months and my dream was to go get sober at this rehab and come back to Miami, run into this girl on the street and fall madly in love again and run off into the sunset. I did run into her on the street when I got back, but she told me that ship had sailed. So my immediate emotion was sadness. And then my second immediate emotion was relief because it meant I didn't have to be sober anymore. So this will be a theme for the rest of the next 5 years is that I'm never sober for myself. I'm sober to get that girl back and she's not coming back. So, okay. So why be sober?
Got it.
Like I can go drink now. So I, for the next 2 years, I basically just drank and partied and did nothing. No, I worked a little bit here and there, but there was no real life to speak of.
Got it.
So now it's 2009 and I go back to North Carolina thinking that Miami's the problem. So this is the geographic I'm talking about. Like I'm not the problem. Living in Miami where the lifestyle is just crazy, that's the problem. So I go back to North Carolina where in my head, the last time I was successfully drinking and had a job was in North Carolina after college. So I go there and I'm all alone. My apartment's right above a bar. So things get way worse immediately. So I'm starting to drink in the middle of the afternoon, in the morning, just it's constant, no job, can't get a job because I'm always drunk. I give myself cancer in my mouth. I had an ulcer on my tongue that it turned into a squamous cell carcinoma from all the alcohol rushing over it from the drinking. So I got that removed. And then a month later, I fell off a balcony, 35 feet, drunk after a tailgate. None of this stopped me from drinking. I looked at these as like, I'm a survivor. Let's rock and roll.
Yeah.
That was my take on the whole situation. So now 2009 to 2000.
Did you have any injuries following the 35 feet?
I chipped my elbow.
Wow.
That's it. Yeah. Walked out of the hospital I was sore, but I had no serious injuries at all.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And you walked out of the hospital 3 hours later?
3 days later.
3 days later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, basically, I mean like, something's
let's drink to that.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Like, let's drink to that. Like, and I was like a local celebrity almost. Like, oh my God, you're the guy that fell off the balcony. Like, yeah, trots around. Yeah.
Yeah.
So none of this, what's crazy is that none of this correlated to me. Like, alcohol's the reason for this. Like,
sure.
You have a problem with drinking. Like, I had been to rehab, but I was like, these are just bad nights.
Right.
And it's like, this is insane thinking.
Yeah.
So 2010 rolls around, and finally, these bad things kept happening and like nothing was happening in my life and girlfriends kept leaving me and there was fighting in my family and like just a big, big problem. So finally in 2010, I said, all right, I think I need to be sober now. So I went to this rehab in Atlanta for 4 months. I got out of there and I was like, I'm going to go back to Florida because there's a lot of recovery down there and it's good. And I got out of this rehab and again, I knew I needed to be sober, but I had reservations. I was scared of life without alcohol. Like I was scared of going on dates. I was scared of going to football games.
Uh-huh.
I was all the social stuff, all the social like lubricant. It's why I used alcohol.
Right.
Because when I was a kid, I had really bad social anxiety from being sick. I had really bad asthma and allergies. So I felt very different from all my peers.
Got it.
And they would make fun of me for my breathing, for not being able to eat desserts at parties and stuff like that. Like, you're different. Let's make fun of you.
Okay.
So this caused like major social anxiety in me. So I avoided social situations.
Got it.
And that's when I started playing tennis. Now tennis comes in because it's an individual sport and it allowed me to be more focused on tennis than socializing with my friends all through high school. This was, so I would be, instead of going to parties on the weekends, I would be playing tennis tournaments all around Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, all that stuff.
Got it.
So and that, to me, that was fine because I hated being social anyways because it just felt so awkward.
Yeah.
Then I got to college, played tennis in college. So tennis took the priority over alcohol until I stopped playing tennis.
Right.
So through college, I was on the tennis team, and that was always a priority. I drank occasionally here in college, probably on the weekends.
Yeah.
Like a college kid does. But if I ever had a match on a Saturday or something like that, I would stop. Like, tennis was always a priority.
Yeah.
No question about it. And so as college finished up and the tennis career kind of went away, this is when the partying kicked in at age like 23, 24, 25.
Sure.
Living in Charlotte, job in a bank, making good money. Rent was super cheap.
Yeah.
You know, five guys living in a house from college, basically a fraternity house in downtown Charlotte. And so the partying kicked in, but I was always able to control the drinking to the point where I could like go out on Friday and Saturday night, sometimes Thursday night, make it to work on Friday and definitely make it to work on Monday. So there's no consequences in my life for the drinking and the partying. When I moved to Florida, that's when the consequences kicked in. So by consequences, I mean like relationships started to fall apart.
Sure.
A lot of friends were like calling me up, be like, hey, you all right? Or like some friends would be like, dude, you're like, they pull me aside, like, you're a joke. Like, people, like, talk about how wasted you get.
Got it.
And I'm like, you know, it's all right, whatever. Like,
sure.
So I would clean up my act for, like, a month,
2 months,
something like that, and just be presentable and, like, get people off my back and all this. And then that led to those 3 years, 30 to 33.
Got it.
Where I wasn't married anymore. I wasn't playing tennis anymore. So there was nothing in my life.
Did alcohol break up your marriage?
No.
Okay.
The marriage fell apart just because when we were in North Carolina, we met there. She had her group of friends. I had my group of friends. We had our group of friends.
Yeah.
And everyone was kind of getting married and it was the thing to do. And we were in love. There's no question about it. But we got to Florida and it was just me and her and we just stopped getting along.
Got it.
It just ended up being like not the right place for either of us.
Okay.
So we separated. And then this is kind of after the fact is when the alcohol and the drinking and all that stuff started to like take a toll on me personally as like, I had no more governors on my life for the tennis, the wife, the family, whatever it was, the asthma, the allergies, all that stuff was gone. And I was just, for the first time, there was just me and just whatever my decisions were.
Got it.
And they were all based around partying.
Yeah. So you mentioned that your uncle and your sister went to rehab. Yeah. So
his daughter. Yeah.
So is this something, was it only those two or were there other people in the family?
A lot of times, alcoholism it runs in families and there's a lot of reasons from childhood, whether it's an alcoholic household or stuff like that, that can contribute to alcoholism. My immediate family, I was the only one. This uncle and his daughter are actually relatives by marriage. So they're not actual relatives of mine as far as like blood and DNA and all that stuff. So to say like the alcoholism runs in the family, my dad's dad, had a problem with alcohol. It was way, way back in like the 50s and 60s. And so it wasn't really looked at as like a problem then. I mean, it was AA was still around and stuff like that, but it was kind of more accepted for like the man in the house to come home and have some drinks and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really ever like a real problem. Like looking back, yes, he was an alcoholic and there were some behaviors around there, knowing what we know now kind of thing. But as far as like having any markers of a family dynamic for me being an alcoholic, there were none.
Okay. And then so when you were in North Carolina with living with the five guys, you were like you were drinking like normal, like a normal guy with five roommates would do. And then you got married. So when you were married to that girl, were you guys drinking a lot then?
Yeah, we did. We and all of our friends. I mean, we got married at 27.
Okay.
Divorced at 29. We started dating when we were 25.
Okay.
So basically together from 25 to 30.
Yeah.
We partied together on the weekends. Our friends partied. Like we all kind of, that was the thing we did.
Yeah.
Again, there was no consequences. Like we all made it to work on Mondays.
Yeah.
There was a few really drunken nights in the household and stuff like that, but there was never like abusive or anything like that. And the alcohol never caused any infidelities or anything like that. We did it together.
Yeah. So you started drinking 24 and things just got worse and worse and worse every year sort of thing. And then really exponentially worse at age 30.
Yes, that's exactly it. So looking back, I can pinpoint a few experiences even growing up in high school and through college where it was like, that's a little bit abnormal. And I can even say like now looking back, like I even felt a little abnormal the next morning. So I talk a lot to my clients about like, there's a physical hangover from alcohol, like the feeling of like the headache, the dehydration, they're just feeling like crap the next day. But the emotional hangover is the one that's the red flag, because everybody gets hungover. But when you have an emotional hangover from alcohol, which I can relate, I can go back to like high school and feel like when you wake up and just like something wasn't right about that, like not physically, but just like I don't feel like that was the right thing to do, or there's something that sticks with you emotionally. That's kind of the big red flag. And I can pinpoint a lot of times from age 18 to 30 from that happening. And then the actual consequences started to set in where it was the shame and the guilt.
So if somebody's waking up with that feeling, what do they do?
I would recognize it first, to talk about it. Look at the behaviors around it. Like look at why you feel like that. Did something happen? Do you feel guilty about something? Do you notice a Jekyll and Hyde syndrome, which is some keywords in recovery. Uh-huh. Like a lot of people will say, when you drink, you kind of amplifies your mood. But when I drank, it was Jekyll and Hyde. Like I was two completely different people.
Right.
I'm kind of shy and introverted and quiet when I'm not drinking. I used to be this way anyways. And when I was drinking, I was up on the bar doing shots and at the party, telling jokes, dancing around. So if you have that emotional response to alcohol and then you look back at the night and you say, one good gauge of it is like, I was always like, I would avoid the people in my life that were, this is why I would go AWOL. It's because I would avoid the people in my life that actually knew me and cared about me when I was drinking, because I was such a different person. I didn't want them to see that different person.
Sure.
Whereas some people are like, the family gets together and it's like, let's have a good time. And everyone's laughing because they feel comfortable around these people drinking because they know they're not going to do anything wrong. So if you notice those feelings of that kind of gap between like who you are and who you are drunk, that's when you should probably take a step back from drinking and see what happens.
Okay.
Because like for an alcoholic, if you stop drinking, your life will get markedly better. You'll feel better. Like your anxiety will go down. A lot of times anxiety and depression, because the basis of it, I always say anxiety is depression turned inward. Depression is anger turned inward.
Okay.
And anxiety is just, you know, fear of living in the future, like fear of like, oh my God, I have to face someone that I was drunk around and I don't know what I said.
Right.
So if you stop drinking and you notice all these things dissipate, it's probably a good idea to take a look at the drinking.
Got it. Okay. So, you know, you go to Utah.
Yeah.
You've been sober since. What was the path of your life from there? But what did you get into after that? Because now we're here at a coaching group here in California and you can talk to anybody and you've clearly overcome a lot of the social things that got you in trouble in the first place. So, tell us about that hero's journey.
Okay. So, after sober living in Utah, I was staying with a friend of mine. And he had a basement that was kind of built out into a little apartment, but he had a big family event coming up in the fall. His daughter was getting married. So he had a ton of family coming in. So I had to get out of there.
Yeah.
And that wasn't like he kicked me out. It was like, this is the deal. You can stay for a month, but then, And I was like, oh, cool. I'm going to LA anyways. Like I was dead set on being a sports agent and going to LA and being a sports agent.
Okay.
And that was my like calling in life. Like I was supposed to do that. I love sports. I have a sports management background. Mm-hmm. That was it. So I was like making all these moves to try and get to LA and nothing was happening.
Okay.
Like first of all, I didn't have a license. So going to LA without a driver's license in a car is a death sentence. There's no public transportation.
Right.
It's terrible. Like, and it's so spread out, getting around anywhere is going to be miserable. But I was like, you know what? I can get around that. So I would come to LA and look for apartments and there was nothing. Like no apartments were available, or if they were, by the time I wasn't able to make a move on it, they would close down. Like someone would be moving in. Uh-huh. It's like all the doors to LA were closing, but I was dead set on it. So it got to the point where I was fighting with my family about it because they wouldn't support the LA move. I was fighting with friends about it. I was fighting with everybody I could fight with about my counselors at the sober living house. I'm going to LA, damn it. And so that went on for 2 months, better part of 2 months. And so finally, I hadn't talked to my sister, Abby, who lives in San Francisco, in 5 years because of my drinking. She cut me out of her life. She's like, I love you, but I can't support this lifestyle. You're doing terrible things to the family.
Yeah.
And so she has a house in San Francisco and an extra bedroom. And so my dad suggested, he's like, why don't you call up Abby and ask her if you can stay with her for a few months? I was like, I don't know. Like we haven't talked in 5 years, but I did. I called her up and I apologized to her for my behavior. I basically made an amends to her.
Yeah.
Excuse me, for my behavior over the past 10 years, basically 8 years. And I said, I'm kind of stuck. Like I don't have anywhere to go. I'm going to eventually go to LA, but I just need a place to go for a few months to get myself back on my feet. And so this was me. I didn't see it right at the time, but I did shortly afterwards. This was me letting go of control of, letting go of holding on too tight to an idea of what I thought that, or what I thought I needed to have in my life.
Yeah.
And so I basically said, okay, this is the plan. I'm going to turn it over. Like, okay, fine. I'll go to San Francisco for 3 months, but I'm going to LA. Like I was adamant about this.
Sure.
So I get to San Francisco. I move in with my sister. I go on a job interview with a temp agency, just to do temp work so I can find something permanent. And they see my commercial real estate background on my resume and they hire me on the spot. So I'm now in San Francisco 2 days in, I have a job. And from that job in 2 weeks, I'll end up getting an apartment from one of the girls that works there in a rent-controlled apartment. So I just moved to this city that I don't want to be in, but I have gotten a job in an apartment in a city where there are no jobs and no apartments.
Right.
And they both fell in my lap. And so, and also not only that, but I had been going, my first thing in San Francisco was I'm going to AA meetings, not bars.
Right.
Which is my normal MO, was go to bars and meet people. So I went to AA meetings and I made amazing friends, like guy friends, like guys that I can be open and vulnerable and cry in front of and talk about my life to, like real stuff. So after about 6 months, I was like, you know what? My life has gotten really good since I got to San Francisco, since I let go, since I stopped being like, this is the way it's going to happen. Like, and since I gave into the process and just said, you know what I'm going to do, instead of making what's next and what I think should be next, I'm going to do the next thing that's in front of me, no matter what it is. I'm going to do that right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do the next thing that's in front of me, and I'm going to do it the best that I can. And so 6 years later, I'm still in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And my life is amazing. So after that, I got that job. It was a recruiting job. And I did it for about 6 months, but I realized it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
It was soul-sucking. It was cold. I had been cold calling for 10 years in commercial real estate in Miami to build a business there. And I just wasn't interested in doing that again.
Got it.
In an office. So the boss calls me into her office and she's like, Sam, she's like, this isn't working out. And I'm in the back of my head, I'm thinking, I know. Like, thank you. Like, thanks for freeing me from this. She's like, here's your last commission check. Wish you all the best. I'm like, yep, no problem here. Let's go. So as I was walking out of that office, I called up NASM, National Academy of Sports Medicine, and got my person and signed up for their personal training program.
Okay.
And that was something that I had wanted to do for a long time because of my tennis background, like having been trained, having been an athlete, I loved the idea of working with athletes. And in my time in Miami, I did actually train tournament level tennis players.
Okay.
For off-court conditioning. So it was my first kind of semi-introduction to it. And I had some friends that were doing personal training and I was like, you know what? And so I started doing it and it was again, like just like the moving to San Francisco, like things started to fall into place. Like it started to fill my heart up and it started to fill my soul up and I was good at it and I could help people. And like the people who come back to me with like these stories about how like an ex-girlfriend saw them and they're like, oh my God, what are you doing? And like, oh, I'm working with this trainer. And like, they come back and tell me these stories and I'm like, this is amazing. Like I'm helping people and I'm doing something that I love and I don't feel like I'm ever at work. Mm-hmm. I'm working in a gym. I get to work out, like all this stuff falling into place. So I did that at Equinox for 2 years. And then I went off and started my own business. Mm-hmm. And did independent personal training in San Francisco. And same thing, like it was just an amazing experience. I worked at an amazing gym in San Francisco. And then I actually moved to Denver for two months because my father passed away in 2015 suddenly. I was in an AA meeting and the guy talking was talking about how his parents had both passed away. And I was like, I'm not in the mood to hear this today. So I left about 15 minutes early and I got a call as I walked out from the Asheville, North Carolina Police Department saying my dad had passed away.
Wow.
So total shock. And so flew home, took care of that. And then came back to San Francisco and basically kept personal training, But I had this, all of a sudden I had this, like, I guess I want to do more. Like, I always been into personal development and Tony Robbins and all these guys, like following stuff like that. And I was like, you know what? I need to do more in this respect. So I didn't do anything about it, except that I kind of like had in the back of my head that like, I'm going to start doing this with my personal training clients. I'm going to start helping them with their life. Mm-hmm. Just like, as I'm doing sessions, I'm going to talk to them about life. So I did that. And then 2018, so 2017, I moved to Denver because I thought that my dad passed away and I had a shoulder surgery.
Okay.
And I kind of got depressed a little bit. And I thought San Francisco was the problem.
Hmm.
I thought it was the weather, because the weather up there is terrible. It's like 55 and gray all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I need summer in my life. So I'm going to move to Denver, where they have summer and they have mountains and skiing and all these things I like.
They actually have the second most sunshine of any city in the United States, behind San Diego.
Like 20 days or something like that?
Well, I know it's like 3,000 hours or something.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It doesn't make any sense because you think Denver snow and all that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but.
Yeah. So anyways, I get there and the girlfriend that I had in California, we had talked about working it out. I get there and it didn't work out.
Uh-huh.
And I get there and I honestly didn't do enough research about Denver. And the personal training industry there is not what it was in the Bay Area.
Like, sure.
The prices aren't the same. The client, because it's the sunniest place or second sunniest place in America. Like, the people don't look for personal training there. Like, they're all outside. They're all hiking. They're all skiing. They're all mountain biking. They're all doing all these things outside. So personally and professionally, it was a bad move for me.
Okay.
So I realized this pretty quickly. And 2 months later, I moved back to California.
Okay.
And but I moved to Mountain View, California, which is south, where they actually have summer, just like it gets up to 85 degrees in the summer. So I got the best of both worlds. The girlfriend came back. We worked it out.
Okay.
So everything worked out. 2018, so I kept personal training. 2018, I'm committing to being a life coach.
Yeah.
So in the spring of 2018, I was like, you know what, this is going to happen. I'm going to keep personal training, but I'm going to take on some full only life coaching clients. So I started building that business. And then in June 30th of 2018, it was a Saturday morning. I woke up, went to a meeting, went over to my girlfriend's house. We were going to go to the pool that day. It was a nice day. And I got a call from a friend of mine, a Facebook message actually from a friend of mine in Vermont. Like, there's a lot of cop cars outside your sister's house. What's going on? I'm like, I have no idea. So I called my mom, who's in Vermont, and I said, why is there cop cars out there at Amanda's house? And she was hysterically crying. And she told me my sister had passed away.
Oh.
And it turns out she had passed away from alcohol abuse. Like, I had paid all these consequences. I had paid the 7 nights in jail, the hospital stays, the psych ward, the rehabs, the DUIs. Like, I had paid all these consequences of my drinking, and I avoided the biggest consequence of death from alcohol.
Uh-huh.
And my sister didn't pay any of the consequences I paid, so it looked really nice on the surface. But she paid the ultimate consequence. She let it kill her. And so my life coaching went from, okay, I'm kind of doing this, to like, I need to help people.
Right.
And I need to help people before they die.
Why did your sister drink?
She was abandoned by her mother really, really young.
Oh, okay.
And then my dad passed away. And so we have the same dad, different moms.
Okay.
But my mom pseudo-adopted her when she was about 8 years old.
Okay.
Because her mom had sent her to Vermont. And so my mom was her mom.
Okay.
But
so was Amanda older than you?
Amanda was 5 years older than me.
Okay.
So she never really recovered from my dad's death. She felt like my dad was the only person in the world that was on her team.
Oh.
Because her mother had abandoned her, and she felt it was just like a thing that she had inside of her.
Okay.
And I mean, it's funny, we talk about it, like, we never thought that. Like, we had never like considered her like separate than us. It was always, she's our sister.
Yeah.
But she struggled with it. And so she drank,
Did she drink before your father's death?
Yeah, she drank before my father's death, but it picked up a lot after the father's death. And then, so my father's birthday was June 28th. Father's Day was 2 weeks before that. And so I had talked to her on Father's Day, and she was like, I'm having a really, really hard time today.
Yeah.
I missed Dad a lot. And so, and she was drinking. And then two weeks later, she was dead.
Wow.
And drinking. So she, I can't tell you exactly why she drank, but I know that she had a lot of just issues dealing with life. And I think the reason that it got so bad is because it didn't look like mine.
Uh-huh.
Like mine, the whole family knew about it. Like, I was in jail. Like I said, I was in the hospital. Like,
right.
I was calling people up drunk. I was causing all these problems. She wasn't doing any of that. So it didn't look like, she had in her mind what alcoholism looks like. And it was me.
Got it.
And so it didn't, and the family did too. So no, there was whispers, but there was no real like, Amanda, you have a problem, you have to go to rehab, like it was with me. Because it wasn't on the surface. So she basically quietly just drank herself to death.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so that happened in the summer of 2018, and then you decided to make a shift.
That was when I decided, I was like, I need to make a shift. So this is when I called up Xander.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what, I was like, I need to figure this out. Like, I need to help. Personal training is great, but I have a superpower, I feel like, recovering from alcoholism. Like, I came through some stuff, and I learned a lot about people and about myself.
Yeah.
And about how to help people, and I can recognize things, and I need to find out how I can bring this to the people.
Okay.
And so that was when it really shifted into fifth gear.
Yeah. And then, so what are some of the biggest lessons and takeaways that you can give people from recovery, even if they're not needing recovery?
So the biggest lessons I can take away from recovery are, the first one is let go of, if you notice something in your life that you're trying to accomplish and you're getting red lights at every turn, look at that, because that means that if there's definitely like overcoming obstacles, that's really great, and being resilient and gritty and that stuff. But if you're literally getting cut off at every turn, maybe let go of that a little bit and look at what's showing up as what's really happening in your life.
Okay.
So take a step back. The second thing, and this was the biggest thing for me, because all my life, like, it's kind of the curse. Like, when I picked up a tennis racket, it all came really easily to me.
Okay.
Like, I was really good at it right from day one. And so I had spent so much time playing tennis that was ingrained in me as like, if I just try something, I'm good at it. So when it came to the commercial real estate, one of the major reasons I wasn't successful in commercial real estate and again in recovery is because I never allowed myself to be a beginner.
Okay.
I would stop drinking and I wanted to be 10 years, 5 years sober like that. When I was in commercial real estate, I wanted to be the top broker in the office on day one. Like, I never allowed myself to learn and to step back and to do the basics. Like, I never allowed myself to be a beginner. So allowing yourself to be a beginner in anything you do in life is the fastest way to success. Like, you can't cut corners and jump right to the top of the mountain right away. It just doesn't work. The last thing I would say is something I learned recently. I was really sick as a kid, and because of that I had social anxiety, and because of that I was an alcoholic.
Right.
I've learned recently, and this was the most freeing thing I've learned probably in the past 5 years of being sober, is that those are separate events. I was sick as a kid. Okay, great. Now what? I had social anxiety. Okay, great. Now what? I became an alcoholic. Okay, great. Now what? So if you tie all those things together, you're tying everything together, and you are constantly tying yourself back to those things as limiting beliefs.
Right, and labels.
Labels, boxes, yeah. You're putting yourself, like you've talked about, the introvert box.
Yeah.
Like, you're as long as you keep telling that story, you're keeping yourself in that box. So it's a so what, now what approach.
Got it.
So I had, I was sick and I had asthma and allergies as a kid, and kids picked on me. So what, now what?
Yeah.
I had social anxiety growing up, or high school and a little bit in college, you know, and I used drinking to cover that up. So what, now what?
Where did you get that phrase, so what, now what?
Mike DeSanti, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Jay Frugio's buddy.
Yeah.
So he told me this. I had these limiting beliefs, and he's like, well, let me tell you, tell me if this makes any sense to you. And he told me this, what I'm telling you now, and I immediately was like lights going off in my head. Later in life, I drank alcoholic and I became an alcoholic. Okay, so what, now what? So when you separate all those things, now I can free myself up. So now I'm a recovery coach.
Yeah.
Like, so I was an alcoholic, and this is when I shifted. There's a big thing about I'm recovering or I'm recovered. I like to say I'm recovered. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Okay. That separates it for me.
Got it.
So now I can go and live my life and do the next thing, which is helping these men take back control of their life before it gets to the point where it got from my sister.
Got it. And then, so, you know, when you went and apologized to your other sister, Abby.
Yes.
Abby. So walk us through that, because I mean, there's people that probably, I mean, anybody can benefit from learning how to ask for forgiveness.
So the biggest thing I can say about, you know, asking for forgiveness, making amends, admitting a wrong and making it right, is what is your intention? So when I went back to Miami and I ran into that girl, and for years after this, actually, I would apologize to her. I'd call her up and apologize to her. I'd send her texts apologizing to her. I would send her emails apologizing to her. And always I would get like short one word answers in response. I can't. It hurts too much.
Yeah.
My intention every time I did that was to win her back.
Yeah.
My intention when I apologized to my family for so long was to get them off my back. So they make me look good in their eyes again.
Yeah.
So whenever now when I really went back and made these apologies, let go of the result. Like you're going to, it's like, it's not about them. It's like we're talking about today with the emails. It's about the reader.
Yeah.
Like it's not about, like I'm saying I'm sorry to you. What did I do to you? I'm sorry for what I did to you. And what can I do to make it right now? So instead of having that intention of this is going to help me and I'm going to be better for this and you're going to see me in a good light again. Like I'm here to make you whole again from what I did to you.
Sure.
So like just looking at any time, like in this making an apology, any time it's just, what is your intention for making that? Are you legitimately making an apology for the other person or for yourself?
Got it. Okay. And then so some guy contacts you, he's been drinking for however long and he's been hiding it. And all of a sudden it's starting to crumble. Like everything that he's been hiding, you know, work and relationships and his kids. And so what's the first thing that you say to this guy when he comes and sends you a message or calls you or meets you in person? Where do you start?
I start with asking him what's going on right now. Like, is he drinking at this moment?
Mm-hmm.
Find out like what, and if he is, let's work on getting him to stop.
Okay.
It can be dangerous depending on how long he's been drinking for. If you need to kind of taper off sometimes, but I will tell him like, listen, you need to dump out all the alcohol in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Like, create the most amount of friction between you and the alcohol that you can. First off the bat, the first thing we need to get you to do is to stop drinking.
Yeah.
We do that. It's a win. It's a step in the right direction. Stop drinking now. It's a step in the right direction because immediately when you stop drinking, your body starts to come back, like your mind starts to come back, like you start to sober up, all that stuff. So then once we get the alcohol taken care of, the rest of the stuff can be handled because you can't, again, this goes back to kind of the making amends. Like if your work is starting to crumble and you see it crumbling, sending out a bunch of drunk emails is not going to make it come back together.
I can't imagine it would.
Same thing with your wife. If your wife is pissed at you for drinking, you know, getting drunk and going to her and pleading that you're sorry and you're going to change when you're drunk is not going to get you very far.
Right.
You know, so you need to first get your ship righted.
Got it.
And then once we get your ship righted, then we can start dealing with the other stuff. And this can be as soon as tomorrow or the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing we have to do, if you're still drinking, is to get you to stop drinking.
Got it. Okay. And then so you went from social anxiety person dealing, you know, using alcohol to overcome that to being this, you know, charismatic guy today. So was that from the personal training? Was that a lot?
Yeah, a lot of it was personal training. I think that a lot of it was AA, like getting up and telling your story in front of AA. Like, so you can get up and tell your story in front of 30 to 50 people every couple of months or so. The personal training was an interaction. A lot of it was, to be honest with you, it was actually like once I got sober, was going out and doing things sober, like going to watch Michigan football games sober, and realizing that no one really there really gives a hoot if you have a drink or not.
Yeah.
Like that was my whole thing. Like I'm going to be sitting at this bar and not drinking. People are going to be looking at me like, what's going on? Like you're a weirdo.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Right.
Like they just really don't, as long as they have a drink in their hand. So separating, like just knowing that like the lights are not shining on me.
Yeah.
Like I'm just a person at a bar. And like not in this knowing that like it's okay and just with getting sober and doing. So there's a phrase that I've heard when I first got sober was to gain self-esteem, you have to do esteemable things.
Hmm.
And so by getting sober and like doing the right thing and like making those amends and like clearing off your side of the street, you build self-esteem. And then once you build that, you realize that you're okay in your own skin, that you can be yourself. And like, and I told someone this the other day, like I've never felt more like Sam than I do today.
That's amazing. That's amazing, man.
And so I think that once people can be like, just be themselves, like really, like if you want to wear like the craziest outfit, like go ahead and do it. Like just when you realize that like people appreciate authenticity, that goes a long way.
So last thing is, you know, somebody is listening to this and they're like, man, I recognize that there is something wrong with my drinking. What do you recommend they do?
I first recommend that they stop.
Yeah.
First of all, like take a look
at that friction in between.
Put the friction, like remove the alcohol. First of all, I would tell someone, whether that's your best friend, your wife, priest, counselor,
sure,
whatever it is, tell someone, like, I think I have a problem with drinking. Remove the alcohol from the house.
Yeah.
Get yourself out of any environment where there's going to be alcohol there.
Yeah.
If you're at, just have an exit strategy.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the first thing is just stop the drinking. Like one drink at a time, just don't pick up a drink.
Got it. And how can, you know, so if somebody wants to reach out and get help from you,
yeah,
Sam, where do they go?
So I have my Instagram is Telos Lifestyle. That's T-E-L-O-S Lifestyle. My website is teloslifestyle.com, and there's a bunch of stuff on there. There's a couple pages about my coaching on there.
Got it.
You can email me at sam@teloslifestyle.com. And I'm actually running a 31-day sobriety challenge, which is 31days.teloslifestyle.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sam. I really, really appreciate sharing, man, because, you know, as a person who used alcohol for not the, you know, for the same types of reasons, mm-hmm, to overcome the social anxiety, I'm glad to have left it in the past as well. So thanks very much, my man.
Thank you very much, Craig. And I will tell you that when I first heard that you talk about your struggles with alcohol, yeah, it kind of endeared me to you and got me more inclined to get in touch with you. So it's a pleasure to know you, man.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it. Now that, my friend, was a story of inspiration, dedication, persistence, and perspective. It makes you think, what's my excuse again? Oh yeah, what is it? What's holding me back? I wasn't on, you know, rock bottom like Sam was, and yet he was able to overcome, so why can't I? No more excuses, all right? No more excuses. Nothing is going to stand in your way. So if you agree, if you think that was helpful, let me know. Send me a direct message on Instagram at RealCraigValentine. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn too, or just email me at support@earlytorise.com. I want to hear what you thought of today's show. And then I would love a 5-star rating over on iTunes, a review there as well. And finally, if you're like Sam and you want to go to the next level, Sam's been in my workshop. He's in my mastermind. He gets my coaching every week. Here's what you need to do next. So visit perfectlifeworkshop.com to apply to work with me at my next coaching event near you or in my brand new 2X and 10 Less program. All right, so I can't wait to meet you and help you build the perfect business and live the perfect life just like Sam. You are unstoppable.